It's the NPR News Update for Monday, June 9th. I'm Phil Picardi. Today on the podcast, Green Line Safety. An update on the Hiawatha Light Rail Line. Control of the yard in front of the new Viking Stadium. Teacher evaluations are due, and food stamp use remains high in the state. First, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency is saying little about when it will issue a key decision that will affect ethanol production. Mark Stile reports.
Ethanol producers, like those in Minnesota's $2 billion a year industry, are worried the EPA will effectively order a cut in ethanol production. The federal agency last year proposed a 6% drop in the amount of ethanol that has to be mixed with gasoline this year. Ethanol supporters, though, hope the agency will back off on that idea in its final decision. EPA spokesperson Nate McMichael says the agency is still analyzing the issue.
We're working on it and hope to have it out as soon as possible.
The ethanol debate is part of the EPA's review of the Federal Renewable Fuel Standard. It requires gasoline companies to blend a certain amount of ethanol into their fuel each year. Many environmental groups and petroleum companies favor a cut in ethanol production. Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, Worthington.
Moose researchers in northeastern Minnesota have had to adjust their study methods, that to prevent mothers from abandoning their calves. Dan Crocker explains.
Last spring, in the first year of the study into the decline of the moose population, researchers placed GPS collars on 49 calves. Of those, 9 newborns were abandoned shortly after they were collared, a rate much higher than researchers had anticipated. This year, the DNR approached the animals on foot rather than helicopter, thinking that would prevent the mothers from fleeing. But lead scientist Glenn Delgity says of the first 12 calves collared, 7 were abandoned.
We're like, what the heck is going on here? You know, it was really a mystery to us.
In a last-ditch effort, the researchers tried just collaring the calves, a process that only takes a few seconds, rather than spending about 4 minutes collecting other data. And it's worked. Delgity says they've since collared 10 calves with no abandonments. With the new method, they plan to collar another 50 next year. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
The state launches a new road safety campaign today aimed at keeping drivers off their cell phones in construction work zones. Peter Cox reports.
New billboards are springing up throughout the state with the message, "Orange cones, no phones." The goal is to make drivers think twice about picking up their phones in construction areas. The campaign is part of the Minnesota Towards Zero Deaths Road Safety Program, which aims to reduce traffic deaths. Along with billboards, radio ads will also air on stations throughout the state. The program is a combined effort of public safety, health, and transportation organizations. The state had 387 traffic deaths last year, down from 655 in 2003. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A car crashed into a Green Line test train last night in Minneapolis. No serious injuries reported. There have been several vehicle-train collisions since testing began on that line. Passenger service begins on the Green Line later this week, and officials have stepped up a safety push to get people to pay attention to new traffic signals along the 11-mile St. Paul to Minneapolis route. Kathy Werzer talked about it with Tricia Volpe.
What about the stepped-up law enforcement effort?
Well, Kathy, for the last month or so, trains have been running every 10 minutes. And when the Green Line service actually starts on Saturday, people driving, bicycling, or walking around the route, which connects downtown St. Paul to downtown Minneapolis, can expect to see more police officers. Metro Transit is working with the St. Paul Police Department to step up traffic enforcement along the line. There will be 22 transit police officers dedicated to patrolling the Green Line and surrounding community in uniform, plainclothes, and on bicycles. The safety push is part of an education and enforcement effort by Metro Transit and St. Paul Police to make sure everything goes smoothly once the trains start running for real.
Okay, so what should folks be watching for?
Well, trains.
Yep, that makes
number
sense.
One. Also, signs and signals. While the road striping along the route and traffic enforcement signs are not new for the Twin Cities, they are new in downtown St. Paul and along University Avenue. Metro Transit officials say they want people to pay extra attention to signs and signals. Captain Jim Franklin is with Metro Transit Police.
Light rail's not new to the region, per se. It will be new over here. What we're really asking people to do is to pay attention to their surroundings and to obey the rules, obey the laws, watch the signs, and obey the signs.
During the Green Line test period, there were 3 accidents involving cars making improper turns at busy intersections, according to Metro Transit Police. Authorities say they want drivers to pay attention to the traffic signals and hope pedestrians and bicyclists will do the same. Metro Transit Police say they have had no reports of accidents involving test trains and bicyclists or pedestrians yet and hope it stays that way.
So if you want to have a little more information about Green Line safety features, where do you go?
Well, NPR News has created a really cool interactive map with videos that demonstrate some of those safety features. You can also find some interesting facts about the Green Line and historic photos. We have put it all online at nprnews.org.
I bet Metro Transit also has their website.
In fact, Metro Transit does have a whole list of safety features, all of those signs and signals and what they mean. You can go there as well, but definitely check out that interactive map at nprnews.org.
We will indeed, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Tricia Volpe and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. It's been 10 years since the first train started running on the Hiawatha Line. These days, that train line is fulfilling most of its initial promise, although not without some lingering controversy. Tim Nelson has more.
The 11-mile, billion-dollar Green Line doesn't have any passengers yet, but it's already carrying a trainload of hopes that it will revitalize University Avenue, tie St. Paul and Minneapolis together, and help rail transportation become a viable option for the region. But Minnesota has run this experiment before, here along the 12.3 miles of Blue Line track between Bloomington and downtown Minneapolis. How did it work out? It depends on who you ask.
I guess I would say that the Blue Line has been a really strong line, both for ridership and for economic development around the line.
That's Sue Haig, chair of the Metropolitan Council, the agency that runs the transit system. The council says light rail is a success for users. More than 1 in 8 transit trips in the Twin Cities is on a train. Light rail ridership was over 10 million passengers last year, up by nearly a third since its first full year of operation in 2005. At about 31,000 people on a typical weekday, ridership is also nearly a third higher than planners expected for the year 2020. The 11-mile Green Line, by the way, is projected to have about a third more riders than the Blue Line has now. Haig says the Blue Line trains have already helped link key job centers, including the Mall of America, the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, and downtown Minneapolis.
They're designed to have all-day service. They're really designed for different work schedules, different types of employees to get where they need to go.
Critics say that's true, but there may have been better, cheaper ways to accomplish that. Annette Meeks is CEO of the Conservative Freedom Foundation of Minnesota and a former Met Council member. She says the added cost of trains actually crowds out other, more flexible transit like buses.
And so what you end up having is less bus rides, and people having to walk further to get to the transit stops that are now train or rail stops, and a higher per passenger subsidy. No matter how you look at that, that's not a really good return on investment for Minnesota taxpayers, especially the folks who live in greater Minnesota who are never going to hop on board any of these trains.
But moving people around wasn't the only goal of the Blue Line. Boosters also hoped it would spark a revitalization in Minneapolis. At 46th Street, developer Norm Bjornes has 2 housing developments along the train line, including Oaks Station Place, squeezed literally into the parking lot of a light rail stop.
We have 104 apartments, and we have about 8,500 square feet of retail. We have a new restaurant we hope will be opening up this summer as an exciting neighborhood amenity.
Without a ready alternative to cars and parking, he says, land like this along the Hiawatha Corridor wouldn't be practical to develop.
Close to a third of the people that live at Station Place here don't even own automobiles. And that was one of our goals.
And the building was 94% occupied as of last week. Hennepin County says Bjornes' project is one of 91 that have gone up along the Blue Line since 2003, boosting the market value of the real estate from $8.5 million to $154 million. They say property tax revenue has gone up 20-fold and brought new homes and people to the city. David Frank is director of transit development for the city of Minneapolis. He says the corridor between Cedar Riverside and 46th Street is a great example of the boost trains have brought to the area.
So for those station areas only, something like 1,500 units completed and under construction as of a year ago. And I would say it's at least a couple hundred since that time.
All told, officials say there are more than 5,400 new housing units along the Blue Line from Target Field to the Mall of America. But others aren't so sure the train brought prosperity. Sarah West is an economics professor at McAllister College and an author of a study of development around the Blue Line. There's been a lot of building near the tracks, she found, but there's also been a lot of building everywhere else during the housing boom that started about the time the trains did.
So if you think about before and after the light rail is introduced, compare the development that took place around those stations with that that took place throughout the rest of Minneapolis. If you compare that rest of Minneapolis afterwards to the corridor, we're not seeing a difference.
But Hennepin County Commissioner Peter McLaughlin says that's apples and oranges. He says the Hiawatha Corridor was left blighted when it was cleared in the 1960s as an alternative to Interstate 35W, but never rebuilt. He says the area might never have filled back in without light rail.
For 25 years, essentially, nothing happened in that corridor. There was this cloud of uncertainty hanging over it. So the net result from 1960 to essentially 2000 was the only developments that happened in that corridor were gas stations, fast food places, and storage locker places.
He also says the line's worth is showing up elsewhere, like in St. Paul, where development started sprouting up even as the Green Line was under construction. The Met Council says there will be more than $2 billion invested in more than 120 projects built or planned within a half mile of the new train service. McLaughlin says the Blue Line's track record is also helping boost interest in development along the Southwest Corridor to Eden Prairie, even before the deal to build that train gets done.
Hiawatha was the test case, both for the train and for development. We're learning how to do development.
Sarah West, the McAllister economist, concedes there may be more to the story. She says the most recent data is from 2010, right at the depth of the Great Recession and housing crash. West says longer-term and potentially more positive effects of rail may show up when new numbers on development land use are out next year.
And so it's too early to close the book on the effects of the Blue Line on land use.
And starting next weekend, the Green Line will already be opening the next chapter in the story of rail transit in Minnesota.
Tim Nelson for us in Minneapolis, and we're going to stay with Tim for just a few minutes longer. He's our stadium guy, and there are questions about the public park that will be located next to the new Viking Stadium. Critics say Minneapolis may have given too much priority to private Vikings games and stadium events. Here's Tim and Kathy on Morning Edition.
So what's the problem here?
Well, several officials, including former Mayor R.T. Ryback and City Council member Cam Gordon, are questioning the rights the city's giving to this new park. We're talking about two blocks, essentially, here between 4th and 5th Streets and Park and 5th Avenues. It's where the Star Tribune building stands and the parking lot that's across the street. They're two of five blocks purchased by Ryan Companies for that big Wells Fargo campus over there, and part of the deal will leave the southern two blocks open. The city's going to turn it into a downtown park. But because it's just west of the new Viking Stadium, the team will have use of the park for all its home games. That's two preseason games and eight regular season games. In addition now, the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority, that's the agency that's building the new stadium, will have rights to use the park for an additional 40 days a year. That'll be for things like high school tournaments and other events. Now, if you add all these up, including setup and takedown time for tents and equipment, those rights to the park could account for almost 20% of the year, and even more if the Vikings exercise their rights to bring a Major League Soccer team to Minneapolis.
And we're talking about a public park here. So why did the city make the deal in the first place?
Well, there's a lot of factors that went into this agreement, but the biggest is money. The park, including land acquisition from the Star Tribune, cost $19.8 million. The city sold $18 million in bonds to pay for that, but the Stadium Authority plans to pay the city back with parking money. Here's how Michelle Kelmhagen, the chair of the authority, explains it.
What we are doing, it is literally 100% of the bonds that are going to pay for that block and two-thirds of park space. Those bonds are being paid for by our parking revenues.
That parking she's talking about is an existing underground ramp by the light rail stop, plus a new 1,600-space parking ramp being built kitty-corner from the stadium. The Stadium Authority owns both of them.
Okay, this is a little complicated. So the Stadium Authority is buying the park.
They're essentially promising to pay the mortgage. The city is going to actually own it. But that's not the whole story either. Those parking ramps are part of the overall stadium deal, which means they're essentially a joint project of the Vikings and the Stadium Authority. Plus, the Vikings kicked in an additional $1 million at the end for the park last year. And that's not even all. The Stadium Authority gave Minneapolis the development rights on top of that new ramp being built. The city turned around and sold those air rights to Ryan Companies for a new Radisson Red Hotel and a 27-story apartment complex for $5.6 million. So add all that up, that's a total of more than $25 million for the city.
For the city. But isn't the city helping to pay for the stadium?
They are. They're putting in $150 million up front and more than $7 million a year for operations. And, you know, theoretically, the city could have built a parking ramp of its own there right by the stadium and Wells Fargo, paid for this new park with revenue of its own from drivers coming in there. But it's really hard to argue that they'd be able to do that or any of this would happen without the $850 million that the Vikings and state taxpayers are putting up for the stadium. The Vikings and the Stadium Authority are getting a big chunk of the park, but they're paying a lot.
Okay, so what's next then?
Well, Cam Gordon, the city council member, says he wants to renegotiate this deal. Ryback even said in an op-ed in the Star Tribune that it's time for the city to play hardball with the Stadium Authority and the Vikings. But the deal is in place right now, and it's unclear how hard a bargain the city can drive with the Stadium Authority and the Vikings footing the bill.
All right. Tim Nelson, thanks for the update.
You're welcome.
As the year comes to an end for students, Minnesota's school districts are the ones with a big summer homework assignment ahead. Districts need to have new teacher evaluation systems in place by fall. It's unclear if all the state's districts will be ready because some are still developing their plans. Tim Post reports.
The majority of Minnesota's 333 school districts are ready now to implement their new teacher evaluations in the fall.
Roughly three-fourths of our school districts have plans ready to go.
Denise Specht, the head of the State Teachers Union Education Minnesota, says the rest of the districts still have work to do. In 2011, lawmakers revamped Minnesota's teacher evaluation law. Under the old system, some teachers went a decade or longer without getting proper feedback on their work. Now, new teachers will get formal evaluations every year for 3 years. Plus, they'll meet on a regular basis with veteran teachers. Experienced teachers themselves will get a formal evaluation once every 3 years. The law requires districts to develop evaluation systems with their local teachers' unions. They need to be approved by both union members and school boards before September 1st. One option for districts is to use an evaluation model developed by state education officials. 17 Minnesota districts piloted some or all of the state model this school year. The Caledonia District in southeastern Minnesota got a $70,000 state grant to give it a spin. Superintendent Ben Barton says it was a big improvement over the previous system, which required teachers be evaluated during their first 3 years on the job.
It's taking us away from the days where, you know, teachers closed their doors and they taught in a silo and did their own thing. And this model, you know, really pushes people to work together and collaborate as a team.
He likes the state's model, but Barton found it required too much paperwork and too many classroom visits for already busy administrators like himself.
There's some pieces in there that aren't practical, and that's why we had to pare it down and just make it more user-friendly for us.
Caledonia is working with teachers to develop its own evaluations. Janelle Field-Rohr heads up the Caledonia Union and teaches English, history, and art to middle and high school students. Rohr says the state's evaluation model proved burdensome, particularly for the district's special education teachers, who were required to write student goals twice because district and state paperwork didn't match up. She wants the district's own evaluation system to be streamlined.
I'm hoping it won't be too overwhelming. I mean, paperwork's going to be a part of it. You know, we have good teachers in Caledonia. I know they'll work through it, but it's going to be something to learn.
State education officials expect fewer than 20 of Minnesota's more than 300 districts to use the state model for their evaluation systems.
The state model is one way of meeting those requirements, but certainly not the only way.
Tyler Livingston is the educator evaluation specialist for the Minnesota Department of Education. Livingston says the state's model is an example of best practices, and districts can create whatever teacher evaluation system works best.
There's few ceilings, if you will, to what possible practices could emerge from this work, so long as it meets with the criteria that's laid out in the statute from the legislature.
Districts in Minnesota's QCOMP system, which uses state money to reward teachers for their performance, need only to tweak their existing evaluations. Close to half of the state's districts are in QCOMP and can use $75 million in state funding next school year to pay for evaluations. Non-QCOMP districts, there are 188 of them, will have to split $11 million. State Teachers Union President Denise Specht says lawmakers should consider giving more money to districts.
This is one-time money, and we are going to have to come back next year and talk about, you know, funding this so we can do this well.
Specht thinks even if all the state's districts are able to get their evaluation systems in place by the fall, they'll likely need to tweak them during the first year of implementation.
Tim Post on the NPR News Update. By all measures, Minnesota's economy is in much better shape than it was just a few years ago. Housing prices are rising. Unemployment is falling. So you might think fewer people would be relying on food stamps and food shelves to make ends meet. But as Matt Sepik reports, that's not the case.
Minnesota's unemployment rate was 4.7% in April, exactly the same as it was in April of 2004. But the number of people using food stamps, now called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, is double what it was a decade ago. Today, more than 500,000 Minnesotans get SNAP benefits. Colleen Moriarty is executive director of the nonprofit Hunger Solutions Minnesota. She says most SNAP recipients work, but often their jobs don't pay what they used to.
We know there's about a three-year lag in after you've been unemployed for a significant amount of time for people to be able to be back on their feet fully again.
Moriarty says social service agencies made a big push to sign up those eligible for SNAP during the recession. However, the 2014 Farm Bill now prohibits such groups from advertising the program.
Matt Sepik closing out the podcast for this Monday, June 9th. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for listening to the NPR News Update. I'm hosting Morning Edition tomorrow, so John Wanamaker will have the podcast on Tuesday.